Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. This week, I make my way to Manhattan to chat with Chef Amelie Kang about her delicious dry pot restaurant, Mala Project. She's on the verge of opening up a new location in Greenpoint, and she shares her stories of growing up in Tangshan, China, making her way to the CIA in New York, and how grandma still knows best in the kitchen. And then it's a dip into the archives when Dead Stars visited the HRN Shipping Container Studio to play some songs, talk about their new EP from 2013, High Grain, and then share what they like to eat on the road. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network.
Staring at the sun.
Amelie, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Thanks for sitting down with us. Always great to check in with people from New York City, one of my favorite towns to eat in. Thank you, and welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Sure, thanks for having me.
I was reading about you and read that you grew up in Tangshan, China. You talked a lot about your grandma and your parents cooking a lot. What do you remember about their food and what it meant to have home-cooked meals growing up?
Yeah, my grandma, she had an outdoor kitchen. And I just remember so vividly growing up standing on the little stool and trying to watch whatever she's doing. And she has she just has one stove where it's a Chinese wok stove. You know, obviously one cleaver, and she does everything with that one knife and one wok. All of a sudden she cooks a meal for like six people in the family within 30 minutes.
Love it.
Yeah, it's definitely, it feels like magic. And I remember, actually I forgot about this, but my grandma reminded me when I was younger, when they asked me what my dream would be. And I used to say I wanted to be a food critic. I had forgotten about this. And then after I opened the restaurants, they said, oh, your dream come true.
So how long or how old were you when you went from just a watcher to actually cooking in the kitchen? And was it something you wanted to do, or was it, okay, you're old enough, it's part of your chores?
Yeah, I started this baking class with a chef from New Zealand, because I had a lot of free time. I was attending to an international high school, and the class work wasn't as intense. So I was very intrigued. I always liked eating growing up, but because grandma does all the cooking, I never even thought about cooking myself. But I picked up baking, and I realized how much I love it. It's something that was already in me, and I was so obsessed with it. That's basically all I could think about is baking, what kind of butter, what kind of eggs I'm sourcing, and, you know, making different croissants and macarons every weekend with this, with my teacher. I didn't really get into the kitchen until I was 17 years old. And then I went to the CIA where I started going to the culinary side from the baking side.
Before we get to the CIA, you bring up an interesting point about your grandma cooking and you thinking like the kitchen's hers. I'm not going to get involved, but I know that your parents also cooked. So at some point there was, if not a handoff, at least a like parallel path of cooking in kitchens. When did you notice that your grandma and your parents were cooking for you? And when did you think it would be your turn to get in the kitchen?
I mean, I still, till this day, I still have no space in the kitchen. I have no say. There's just not enough room for me.
You're like, I own restaurants, multiple restaurants. And they're like, Could you go bake something for us, please?
Yeah. They're like, okay, go watch TV and eat some fruits. So it's interesting because everybody had their own job in the kitchen. So everybody had their signature dishes. And when it comes to holiday season, everyone just stick to what they do the best. Mm-hmm. My grandpa is the rice maker. My uncle, he does the hong shao rou, the red braised pork. Mm-hmm. Grandma does scallion pancakes and all the other things. My mom does congee. So everybody just, it's always the same dishes that they cook every year. Mm-hmm. But they just, you know, they take turn and then they do their things in the kitchen and then they get out. The kids are just, we can help peeling some garlic and stuff.
Sure.
We're never needed.
Never need it. If there's some green beans you can snap, you can get and clean those.
Sure.
So you mentioned going to the CIA. How did you first hear about it, and what was your reputation, and what did your parents think about you going to New York to go to cooking school?
Yeah, because they definitely didn't pay all that money for me to go to a culinary school.
No, ma'am.
No, I mean, back then, and even till now, culinary school is not a college. It's more like a vocational school in China, and there is no college that would provide you a bachelor degree if you are majored in culinary arts in China. I remember I was applying for school, and I was going for marketing or communications, something along the advertising line.
Sure.
And I just couldn't stop picturing how miserable I will be in sitting in a cubicle and staring at a screen. And I thought, okay, well, instead of searching for schools, I would spend time looking for restaurants and new bakeries that's opening up that I can go visit during the weekend, because it was a boarding school. And so I thought, oh, why don't I wonder if there's any culinary school that will give me a bachelor's degree in the U.S. And lo and behold, there's Johnson & Wales and there's CIA.
Sure.
So I said, this is what I'm going to do. And I remember turning to my best friend who was sitting right next to me. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to do any of these. I'm done. I'm going to apply for culinary school. Yeah. And I went home that weekend. I told my parents about my plan. And my dad, he's always been supportive of, he's the one that says, like, if it makes you happy, if you think you can do good at it, go for it. And my mom took a little bit more convincing.
Sure. So once you got to New York and you're at the CIA, what did you wind up cooking there? How much was the focus of it with Chinese food, or was it mostly European, style cuisine?
Yeah, definitely. All the foundation is based on French cuisine. Mm-hmm. There's a huge focus on Mediterranean, French, modern American, but not a lot of emphasis on Asian cuisine at all, let alone Chinese. We have three days of class that focused on Chinese cooking. And
how many days of classes overall, just so people know?
It's a 3-year, the cooking program is a 2-year program.
Right. Okay. Just good to know for relative sake. Right. 3 days.
Yeah. So we had three whole days of Chinese cooking, and I had actually taught some of the class, like some of the 3 days. There was one day where I showed everyone how to make dumplings. And there's another one. We made some Chinese cabbage and stir fry dishes.
You're like, but, am I going to get some of my tuition back if I'm teaching?
Yeah, definitely not a lot of emphasis on Chinese cuisine. And even till now, I don't believe there is.
So you're there in New York City, which almost every borough has an incredible Chinatown, whether Chinatown, New York, or in Flushing, or out in Brooklyn and Sunset area. Were you going out to eat? Were you homesick for the food you grew up with? How were you getting a taste of home?
Yeah, I was definitely very against going to Chinatown when I first moved here. I thought I grew up with this type of food for the past 18 years. I don't need to.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't really need to experience, so to speak. And that was definitely very kind of a arrogant way. And it was not very a limited thinking, I guess I could say. But we were just coming down to New York basically every other weekend, and we would go to all of these new American restaurants, fine dining, Michelin stars, French cuisine, and it was so exciting to all of us. And you can imagine a group of young chefs go in New York, and it was, we were just in heaven. We would like eat from 8 a.m. until midnight, and then take a train back to Hyde Park. But it wasn't until after I moved to New York City after graduation, I started learning more about Chinatown and learning about the people that are in it and the history. And so I started appreciating it much more.
Yeah, I mean, it's so deep. And I'm out in LA, and the San Gabriel Valley is so deep as well, with the amount of regional and very specific esoteric type of Chinese cooking that sometimes you just feel transported to to China or into the different regions. And I found the same in New York, that the deeper, especially when you get to Flushing, when you really get into Queens, you're like, it's an education in some ways, at least for me, at least for me. And it'd be like, I didn't know about this region. I didn't know about this food. Start talking to people and they're like, we do this as close to as we can at home. If we can't import it, then we grow it. And, you know, we try to recreate the flavors of what we grew up with.
Yeah, 100%.
All right, let's take a quick musical break. And when we get back, I want to talk to you about life right after culinary school, where you cooked, and how you got the first idea and started opening up the Mala Project. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Was 45, they gave her 40 years to die. But why, oh why, oh why, he pulled his heart away and said his last goodbye. Too soon to die. We'll need more time. We're
'Snacky Tunes. We are with Amelie Kang, founder and CEO of the Mala Project. So you've graduated culinary school. You're back in the city. You've opened your heart and your stomach to Chinatown. Mm-hmm. Where were you cooking? Did you still gravitate to European cuisine and that fine dining? Because that's sort of where the success was, or the financial, I don't want to say security, because financial security in the chef world is a bit of an oxymoron, but is that where you could get jobs, especially coming out, you know, with your bachelor's from the CIA?
Yeah, I actually was cooking during my externship, during my third year in culinary school, my second year going into the third year in culinary school. And I was cooking at Bar Boulud. But I was on the garde manger station. So slicing deli meats, working with all the charcuterie, not much action, but I would help out as much as
in
I
the
could.
Mix. Yeah.
As they allow me. So I would stay overnight, help out with the events, so that the chefs are you know, they would let me to stay over, and I try to learn as much as I can. And I tell them, you don't have to pay me until corporate came in and they said that you have to stop doing this. And I was like, okay, fine, I'll go home. but I was there for, I think it was 6 months or was it 7 months. And then I realized I was not going to go back to the kitchen. So I actually returned to CIA. We finished our management courses the last year of our bachelor degree. And then I graduated and started looking for other positions within the restaurant. And I ended up taking a assistant manager job at this place called China Blue. And it was a Shanghainese restaurant in Tribeca. And I thought they were so audacious to do what they were doing. It's a 3,000 square foot space in Tribeca of all places.
Wow.
Very grand, beautiful, gorgeous space. The owners, they had, back then it was the only Michelin star Chinese restaurant in the city called Cafe China.
Love Cafe China. One of my favorites.
Legendary Magic. Place.
Yeah. Legendary, magical, just pour me into a booth there. I'll be there all night.
Yeah, absolutely. And they really started this new school Chinese trend. And they were there before anybody else was. They introduced service and nice interior, nice music, and nice decor on top of the food to Cafe China. And then they did the same thing with China Blue. So I took a job there and started my, I guess, front of house journey.
You know, you mentioned an interesting part about the CIA college, which is the business side of it. Because so many times, a lot of these courses, they're 9 months, they teach you how to cook. And then they go, okay, go out into the world. And everyone's like, I'm going to run a business. But here you are, you have a real business education. You have the cooking chops. You're at this Michelin star restaurant that does Chinese food. And there's extra cost for that type of service, decor, and sort of re-education to people who may think of Chinese food as like a cheap, fast, not expensive experience. Did all these things start going into the idea of what your business could look like, of what your restaurant could look like? And did it give you that extra inspiration and push to start thinking about your first restaurant?
I definitely got the sense of what kind of restaurant I wanted to build while I was in college, because looking at the restaurants in Chinatown and just the existing Chinese restaurants back then, I felt angry because I thought all of these people, they're putting out the most delicious, wonderful food, but they don't realize customers are not going out just for the food anymore. They're going out for the ambience. They're going out for the music, what kind of connection you're building with the staff. However, the the, you know, the first gen immigrants, they didn't have the resource or even the energy to think about all those things. All they knew was how to make the food delicious and putting it out on the table. And I was kind of upset by how, like, one-dimensional the Chinese restaurants were in New York. So I wrote my thesis on this Chinese restaurant that I wanted to open for graduation, and I wanted to build a place where it's a place where you can go out and take a date. You can it's a place where you can have a business lunch, and you would be proud of it. And not only you will get satisfied from the food, but just the overall 360 experience. And going into China Blue, I definitely that even more solidified that idea, because that's what they were doing, and they were it wasn't enough because they were the only one. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to do this too, but I'll do it my way.
And I assume that thesis and those inklings is what eventually turned into Mala Project.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what was the process like in opening your first spot, especially not being from America, having this very unique point of view, at least unique relative to like what was going on in New York City fine dining at the time, or just restaurants at the time? How did you convince people that you were enough of a sure investment and enough of like a safety that it wasn't that they can, you know, turn this into reality?
Yeah. So we put, it was two of my friends that I was working with at China Blue. They had actually reached out to me when I was leaving the job. They said, oh, if you are planning, if you ever want to open a restaurant, we would love to invest in you. And I thought, okay, cool. And then I said, okay, why don't we do it now? And I talked to my mom. She put in some money. And another childhood friend of mine, she was going to school at the NYU. So it was just four kids and my mom's money. And we had a very, such a tiny, tiny budget. And I thought, I can do this myself. I had run some math and I saw I can do this if I just do a lot of it myself.
Sure.
Yeah. And we just kind of went into it without thinking too much.
I mean, there is no better way to get your start in New York in anything than being like, I can put it all on my back. I don't know how hard it's going to be. And we'll just make it happen. And now here you are on the verge of opening up a fourth one. How do you feel about the journey? How did you feel about opening the first one, first the second one, and the third one? When did you know that like you had grown enough? How did you feel?
Yeah, I think with every single one so far, it's a completely different story, obviously. But one thing that's been consistent is that every time we get to work, we are so focused on just getting the work done. And there's not a lot of time or opportunity to say, okay, let me look up and evaluate. Because when we opened the first one, it was just like, okay, let's find a space. Now is the construction. Now is getting the licenses, and everything just come piling up, and you really don't have time to breathe, but to just keep going down the checklist. And it's the same thing with the second and the third and the fourth one. It's just different things on the checklist. So for myself, my checklist was going from painting the walls to buying the plates for the first location. A lot of the very hands-on, like the small tasks, to now, okay, let me find the manager. Let me set a KPI. So like the checklist is still there. It's just the actual tasks are different. But definitely, I think we're very, very lucky to be able to get to this point. We're still a very small company, but we've grown very steadily. We're going to be 8 years old by the end of this year.
Incredible.
And we only have 3.5. Our fourth one isn't even open yet, but I can't be any more proud of the people we've met and the people we've served and the team we've built. And everyone, we basically grew up together, all the managers and the servers. They're still around. And yeah, and it's my first checklist has become their checklist. And it's incredible to see everybody's growth. It's kind of magical.
I know one of the things you added to the checklist with the new location is a design team. You're bringing in Lauren Day of Love is Enough, which in hearing how you opened the first one, which is like, let's get it open, let's get the paint on the walls, let's get the plates. What made you want to bring in a full designer? What did you feel that you wanted to say with this one, with the layout or the vibe of it, that you didn't have a chance to say with your first three versions of the Mala project?
Yeah, I definitely felt a little bit trapped by doing all the interior and the construction stuff ourselves with the previous three locations. Construction is such a time-consuming and detail-oriented task that if you decided to do your own design and your own build out yourself, then for that 8 to 12 months, that's all you're going to be doing. And when we planned for our fourth location, I knew that I cannot spend another year to focus on construction and design. I also knew that I just didn't have the I didn't have the eye to bring in another, you know, aesthetically pleasing Mala project. And we need to, because each location we're trying to bring in different life and fit it into the neighborhood. And we want to keep surprise people. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to do that. And I think it was pretty clear that it was time to bring in a professional who we can learn from and let the professional do their thing.
Oh, I love it. I mean, that's the beauty of growth, is you get to bring in professionals to do their thing while you get to guide it from what you've built as well.
And admire it.
Yes. And be like, you don't know where all the cracks are painted over. You can be like, oh, this just looks really pretty because I wasn't here hammering all the nails and screwing all the screws. 8 years in, you've built this incredible restaurant group, and it seems like you've changed the perception and added to what people think about Chinese food in the city and beyond New York City. But then you've also built this incredible work culture and the way that people do business. How do you see them going hand in hand? How do you feel about the changes that you've made in the perceptions from the customers and the people that you work with?
Yes, we focused on our team first. And I knew that if we are taking care of our own people well, they're going to be able to take care of their customers well. We spend so much time with each other in the restaurant. You end up, you know, becoming friends with each other. You end up dating each other, maybe. And we just have to make sure that everybody can have a good time together. And it really did happen organically. And I'm very proud of this really delicate culture that me and the team created together. They ended up, you know, they're treating each other the same way they treat the customers. And the customers can feel that, because I don't think, okay, no matter what the business book says, no matter what the, you know, how much you look into the numbers, at the end of the day, this is human to human interaction. And people can feel it from the way that you talk to them, what your energy level is like and how you are. And people can see how you're interacting with each other. So very often I hear stories like some of our team members went out after shift and with our customers. Mm. And the customers are inviting them to their parties. And
that's so cool.
Yeah, and it's not hard. It's precious, the fact that we're able to do that. But it's not hard to do it. You just need to treat each other like human beings and, you know, like friends. And that's basically what we've been advocating with our staff. So even till today, we have a very transparent, I guess, way of communication. If mm-hmm. we want to implement some sort of policy, if we want to make some sort of growth plan, we just make it very clear to the entire team, like it's just another updates with our friends. And so far, I think it's been paying off really well.
Amazing. Listen, I know people can't see the smile on your face at home, but just seeing you talk about the customers and the people and everything you built, it's so great to see. And before we go, I want to make sure that we talk about a little bit the vibe and atmosphere at Mala Project, because when you walk in, it's such a great feeling. What can people expect when they come in, especially like what can they hear on the stereo? Like, what's a night look like at the restaurants?
Yeah, so each location is different. Obviously, mm-hmm. if you come to our East Village location on a weekend night, there's loud music and dim lights and just spicy dry pot flying around. It's mm-hmm. there's a lot of action. But if you come in in the afternoon to any of the locations, it's quite relaxing and you can have a really nice private conversation with a really close friends. And the music, we actually are implementing new playlists. We used to play all the 90s Chinese mm-hmm. music to set the vibe, and now we're trying to play with different types of music and different types of genre. So the music is kind of setting the tone for the ambience as well. And you can see from the customers that's sitting inside of the restaurant, it is really all sorts of people are here. You can see couples on a romantic date. You can see family with little kids and their grandparents. You can see business people in their suit and tie just at different times throughout the day. And I think, you know, that's the magic of Mala Project. It's you can find your favorite dry pot and you can find your spot within the restaurant.
I love it. Well, Amelie, congratulations. Looking forward to seeing the final design and the launch of the new spot in Greenpoint. If people want to come to the restaurant or follow along with your adventures or check out some of your YouTube videos, because I believe it's the scallion pancake you're making in the video, your grandma's recipe?
Yes, just not as good as the one she does.
Of course, on the record, grandma, it's not as good as yours. It's just my attempt. But if they want to follow along, where can they go? Where can they check out all your stuff?
I'm on Instagram at Amelie Kang. We're also on Instagram as Mala Project as a business.
Amazing. Well, listen, thank you so much. Thank you to Skylar and Ashley for setting this up. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Ain't that funny what you do to me? You're my honey, as far as I can see. Then you told me that you found someone new. Ain't it funny what time can do? that funny.
Ain't that funny.
What you do.
What you do.
It ain't that funny. Cause I'm so blue. I could love a million girls or two, but I'll never be over you. I'd give you all of my money, a car or two. I'd pay your rent, well, I'd even steal for you. I could break the law, commit a crime or two. Ain't it funny what love can do? Yeah, ain't that funny?
Ain't that funny?
What you do?
What you do?
It ain't that funny, cause I'm so blue. I could win a million bucks or two, but I'll never be over you. Oh, one more time, Johnny. I'm gonna hit every bar in this doggone town, have a smoke, pop a pill or two, drink some whiskey and eat a big old steak too. Ain't it funny what love can do? Yeah, ain't that funny?
Ain't that funny?
What you do?
What you do?
It ain't that funny, cause I'm so blue. I could drink a million beers or two, but I'll never be over you. I think I'll have a drink with a girl named Sue, but I'll never be over you.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Desars, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thanks hey, guys. Hey, what's up?
Not much. How are you guys surviving? The how's the first half of the show go for you guys?
It was good. It was good. We didn't have to do anything, so that's always easy. You know, just listen.
Come in. Hang out. We'll throw you a little some questions about barbecue.
Right on.
So you guys want to go around the room, do a little intro?
Sure. I'm Jeff. I play guitar.
I'm John. I play bass.
I'm Jay, and I play the drums.
And where are you guys all from?
Jay and I originally are from Jacksonville, Florida, but we've lived here, I don't know, 10-plus years, and John's from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and all over, really.
I got an ex-girlfriend from Jacksonville.
Oh, yeah?
Me too.
You want to play that game?
Yeah, I think we all do.
Okay. We can play it afterwards.
Yeah.
Your girlfriend should never be in the current form from Jacksonville.
Right, exactly.
How'd you guys meet?
Well, he and I are cousins, so we met basically at birth.
Our parents introduced us when we were babies.
Yeah. And you're like, I like your style, kid.
Yeah, I was like, man, you're really cool for like a 0-year-old.
Who picked up instruments first?
I don't know. I think we kind of did at the same time. Yeah, really? Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I think I started playing guitar when I was like 8 or 9 and then stopped for a few years.
Yeah, he got a guitar first, but I remember when I was 5 getting one of those toy drum sets that looked like a real drum set.
Right.
But it was, you know, just like an aluminum, and I'd always bang my mom. Well, that sounds bad. I would always bang my mom. My mom wasn't, let me rephrase that. My mom was an artist, and she had a lot of canvases, and I'd always take her paintbrushes and perform drum type that makes sense either. On the canvases, not my mom.
Okay, yeah. And John,
no more questions.
Yeah. Let's move on to John here. John, yeah, we met John kind of through a mutual friend, and when Jay and I were putting the band together, you know, we were looking for a bass player. But we were mainly looking for someone that we could hang out with that was cool. And we met John. We're like, all right, this guy's awesome. So
what's that situation like? Like, did you guys just get drinks together first, or did you jam first?
I think we drank first.
Yeah, I was tending bar at a restaurant that no longer exists. It was called Santa Fe, then became Elote.
Right on Union.
Which is that place. Yeah, which is right down the street from Jeff's apartment at the time. And Jay and I knew each other, and he was like, hey, you want to join our band? I'm like, yeah. So bring Jeff in. And then Jeff and Jay came into the bar while I was working. Unbeknownst to me, they were actually really nervous, as nervous to meet me as I was to meet them.
Even though I'd met him before.
Yeah. Isn't it always funny when dudes get nervous meeting each other?
Yeah.
I think girls don't understand, because I think there's a lot of pressure for dudes to get new friends or to start projects with
other
dudes.
It's hard to make new friends.
But I wanted them to know I was like a rocking dude. I was rocking things.
Serving like margaritas and like $3 tacos.
Exactly. Yep.
Did you do like an air shred for them when they walked in?
No, I had to play fucking cool. Oh. Can I say
lots of free drinks helped.
Oh yeah, free drinks. Like, I got this, and then after they left, like, thanks. I'm so sorry. Here, I'll cover their tab.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're probably like, oh yeah, that like, dude, all those free drinks. Yeah, that guy's cool.
They might be my new band. Yeah, yeah.
Really, we're looking for is another guy who's a bartender, so Jeff didn't have to hook us up. Hook me up all the time. We needed to get hooked up.
And when was this? When did you guys form?
Like 2009, somewhere around there. Yeah.
All right, well, let's hear a song, and then we'll get into the new EP and all that good stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What are you going to play for us first?
We're going to play this song that we actually heard at the top of the show, acoustic version, of course, but a song called Waste Away.
Awesome. All right, here we go, live on Snacky Tunes.
It was great. I love an acoustic bass. Usually people just forego the bass when they come and play on the show because I don't think that many people play.
I don't think many people own an acoustic bass.
That's, I think, is more the case. Yeah, I guess. It's rare to see an owner.
Yeah.
I inherited this from a friend of ours.
In the 90s, I think.
Oh, yeah.
In the 90s.
Right. Oh, I mean, they stopped making them in 99.
Yeah, I think so.
That's it.
Yeah.
No one's making new acoustic basses.
We exactly. I've worked with Martin Guitars, and they have like a line of acoustic basses, and I had never actually...
They're all vintage.
No, they make some new ones, but I'd seen some...
We're trying to riff here.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah, I mean, they've got Kurt Cobain, like, face
Kurt
plate.
Kurt Cobain. Oh, my God.
Well, no.
Kurt Cobain.
No, I know. I'm just saying it's like just a time dated.
Yeah.
Semisonic.
Yeah, friend of ours, actually the guy that has the barbecues that take a long time, his brother gave us that.
Really?
But he's from the 90s.
Yeah. I feel like barbecues inherently take a long time to get going.
Yeah, yeah. I don't mind that. I like hanging around drinking. Yeah. I like them to laugh. I don't want to get to a barbecue and immediately eat.
Yeah, because
But
how did he end up giving you the bass?
I think he just gave it to him.
Yeah, I mean, he said, here's an acoustic bass.
His brother gave it to him, and he didn't use it. And he was like, hey, do you want an acoustic bass?
We're like, yeah, sure.
Nice guy.
Well, we've had just a couple stories of people getting gifted their instruments on the show, and it's usually a little bit not as basic as that story, but it's like here's this thing that's taking up way too much space that I can't even, like, break out and play at a party. So
no, I think the craziest one was Moon Hooch. You got those two insane...
These guys got
saxophones that they built their entire sound around.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So you guys formed together in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And then when did you know that you guys were all cool enough to be in a band together? Like, when did it all gel?
I don't know. From day one. I don't know.
Yeah. No, that's true. We vibe right away.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, he and I have known each other forever. So it was just bringing one more person into the fold, and we all got along. So, and musically, it just kind of worked. Like, we're all definitely on the same page as far as, like, influences and stuff like that. So it was really easy.
Knew what we were trying to sound like going into it. So that was made it easier to kind of work together instead of, you know, I want to play like this. No, I want to play like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like...
The same similar ideas.
Who are your influences? What do you guys want to be like? Or
I mean,
like?
It's not that we wanted to be like anything. It's just kind of that's what we ended up sounding like when we all got together. But... I mean, you know, we get compared a lot to, like, Dinosaur Jr., like, Pavement-y, like, definitely a lot of early 90s stuff, like...
Hence the bass.
Yeah, exactly.
Hence the bass.
So...
That'd be a good band name.
Hence the bass.
Yeah. What type of music would that be?
early 90s.
I don't know. I think it'd be, like, dubstep, like...
No, it'd be, like Humpty Hump or whatever, like...
Hence the bass, volume one,
right.
Volume two.
It has more, like, a Mumford & Sons kind of...
I don't know if it'd be, a band name, more like an album.
Dead Can Dance.
Yeah. And so you guys have the new EP that's coming out, right?
Or it's out.
Came out Tuesday.
Congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
How does it feel 6 days in? Is it a boy or is it a girl?
It's definitely a hermaphrodite.
It has all 10 fingers and toes.
Yeah.
Okay.
We love it just.
Yeah, we love it just. No, it's good. It came out on this local label here called Uninhabitable Mansions.
Yeah, tell us about the label.
It's a great label. I mean, it's small. They got good distribution. It's run by our friends in this band called Radical Dads. And
that's a good 90s name, too.
Yeah, they're an amazing band, too, and super great people. And they put it out, and we're really psyched about that. And it's been going good. A lot of good reception so far. So
and shout out to Dana Gurley, actually, for hooking us up.
Yeah, definitely.
And how was the EP release show?
It was good. It rained so hard that night because it was on Friday.
Oh.
But it was actually a packed show. A lot of people came out, which was surprising. I thought, like,
well, once you get them there, they're not leaving.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they no matter how bad we play, they couldn't leave.
It's not like a barbecue.
Yeah,
and exactly. Apparently, yeah. If you want to schedule your barbecue, make sure you do it on a day we're not playing because that's guaranteed to be sunny. But if we're playing a show, it's going to rain.
Oh my God!
Exactly. Oh my God!
We had the same. We actually had a 4-year curse of these barbecues that we do. We're in our 6th year. That like it would be like. Beautiful. And then the one day, like there was last year, there was those two hailstorms perfectly a month apart, both fell on our barbecues.
I guarantee you we were playing shows on
and
all
we
those
had
days,
and we
all
had
3 years.
We had to the point where we moved. It was 5 years on Wednesdays, so this year we're like we're moving it to Tuesdays because we just need to know
that. Being said, we moved it to Tuesdays. supposed to rain tomorrow night and be sunny on Wednesday.
Well,
yeah.
I mean,
I'm shitting you. Are you playing tomorrow?
No, I feel you though, because like I said, we played Friday it rained, and then Saturday and Sunday it didn't rain, and then here it is Monday and we're doing something again and it's raining.
We need to just coordinate our schedules because
and then sell those magical powers.
Yeah. Right, well, exactly. It's like we just need to go to like hit the Midwest where there's droughts and just be like, we will come and throw a barbecue and they'll play a show and it'll all be good. Let's hear another song.
Yeah, all right.
Hold on, wait, it just started raining.
Did it really?
What are you going to play for us?
I don't know, what do you guys want to play next?
Staring at the Sun.
All right, we'll do that. It's another song. Yeah.
All right, here we go. Yeah. Dead Stars Live on Heritage Radio Network. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great.
Nice.
So when you just like, do your families be like, how's your guys' band? Or do they have like, do they demean it for a while ever? Like,
no, well, see, it's funny because sometimes you'll tell them something about the band and then they're like, oh, that's cool. And you can tell they don't really get it or care.
Right.
But then like, we just had a tune in USA Today the other day, and you tell them something like that and then they think you're famous.
Yeah, they think you're opening Madison Square Garden next week.
That's like
which paper? Save the article.
Yeah, it's like, no, it's not in print. Yeah.
That's like the New Yorker, New York Times thing for like litmus test for people. It's like your parents like don't really get what you do here until you're like, oh, it's like, oh, I was mentioned in the New Yorker at the time. They're like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
So your little pizza thing's working, huh?
Yeah.
Pizza stand?
Have you guys played any family reunions?
No.
We played a few weddings, to our chagrin, I guess.
We did.
What's life on the road like with you guys? Do you guys van?
Yeah,
bus?
We have a van. It's a really old van. Probably everyone's seen it before. It's completely tagged as shit, and it's like,
oh really?
It's actually it's an urban installation art piece. It really is. Yeah, it needs to go to the Smithsonian when we're done with it.
What's the food situation on the road with you guys?
I don't know. Like,
not good.
you either go to get some fast food, or there's been times where we'll get like a styrofoam cooler and you put a bunch of ice in it and you go to the grocery store and you buy some turkey, you buy some cheese, bread, and then you make sandwiches. But then usually by the end of the day, it's just like sludgy ice turkeys everywhere. And then
you gotta get those really freezer packs.
Yeah, exactly.
It's Roy Rogers if we don't make a lot of money at a certain venue, and it's Applebee's if we, you know, pack the house.
We
love going to Applebee's and like ordering shots at the like little weird tables.
If you've left New York,
there.
There's not a lot of few choices in between the major cities, unfortunately.
What's your meal choice at the old Applebee's?
I used to like their artichoke dip.
Oh, the thing, I remember last time I had it, it tasted like a pie of salt.
I like the sweet and salty dipping sauces.
Oh, yeah, those are really good.
They have big, giant beers, I remember that. That was probably the best.
And all that fake attribute. Memorabilia on the walls of, like, photographs of, like, the local towns and...
Right.
Shenanigans?
Oh, Shenanigans.
Bendigans is way better than Applebee's, though, but there's not too many of them left.
No. And that's got to be, like, a really good night.
There's one in Jersey, like, right over the George Washington Bridge.
Yeah, I think Jersey is one of every ever, like, a Sizzler and whichever's left, Roy Rogers and whatnot.
Medieval times.
It's a museum of every restaurant that ever existed.
So now that the EP's out, what are the summer plans?
Well, we've got a bunch of shows coming up. We're playing Northside Festival this coming weekend.
Hopefully it's not outside.
Yeah, no, it's not.
Rippers?
Yeah, we're playing Rippers August 10th. They rebuilt it.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, so we're
stronger than the storm.
That's going to be cool. And then we have a show July 31st at Glasslands. But basically, in between all that, we're going to start working on songs for a full length.
Rad.
And try to record that sometime in October.
That's gonna be great.
Yeah, so
sounds like that and a couple barbecues and
play some shows, barbecues, work on new tunes.
Summer. Yeah. Well, we want to make sure we have time to have one more song, but we want to give people the nuts and bolts where they can find you guys, buy the EP, etc.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can get the EP. It's called High Gain. You can get it on iTunes. You can also get it through our Bandcamp page, which is deadstars.bandcamp.com.
I love Bandcamp.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's like it does exactly what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
And which is, I feel like I shouldn't have to say that, but it's like, it's just perfect for what
it is. Yeah, and it's a bunch of different formats, which is cool. But yeah, also, you can go to our Facebook page, check us out, like it, do all that crap. But facebook.com/deadstarsmusic, or you can just search it.
Instagram, Twitter, any of that stuff?
We got Instagram. It's all Dead Stars Music. Instagram, Dead Stars Music, Twitter.
We should get Radical Dads on the show.
Yeah, man.
Yes.
That would be rad.
Sure. I think we can help you out with that.
And talk about the label and have them play.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool.
That'd be great.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. We are out next week. We'll be heading back from Bonnaroo.
I'm trying to make that catch up, but I don't think it's going to catch on.
The Bond? Nope. So we'll be back in a couple weeks. Please make sure to come by the barbecue tomorrow night.
Yeah, bbqblowoutjune.eventbrite.com for $10 tickets.
You get to meet us. One of us will be working the door. So
yeah, no, thanks for having us.
Yeah,
thanks a lot.
This is a great guy. And
thank you, Snacky Tunes.
And as always, thank you to Dana and Girly Action for being
definitely.
So.
Shout out to Heritage. Shout out to Roberta's. Shout out to Rippers, actually.
Shout out, yeah, Rippers. Yeah. Good job.
Well done.
I don't know if it's done.
All right, what are you going to take us out with?
We're going to play a song called No Sympathy.
Okay, great. Live on Snacky Tunes, Dead Stars.
When you stay at home with your favorite bone, you can hear the whispering. There's no place to hide when you can't decide, but you feel no sympathy. There's no sympathy. You're so sick of me, yeah.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.